2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 30, to chapter 12, verse 12, the 15th talk in a series on the book of 2 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on September 21, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're coming to the end of our series on 2 Corinthians this week, and then next week, and then we'll be done. Recently, we've been working our way through the last four chapters of 2 Corinthians. I call these chapters Paul Goes to War. He really does use about the strongest language that you'll find him using anywhere. Interestingly enough, today, even though today's section that we're looking at is all about weakness, I would say that it is still very much a part of Paul's attack on his opponents in Corinth. We've been seeing that there are some people who have come into Corinth who have set themselves up against Paul. They've ridiculed Paul as a contemptible speaker. They have denied that he's a true apostle. And Paul is really afraid that many of the Corinthians are listening to them. And that's what brings about the serious tone of this last part of the letter. He is really concerned that they are listening to them. When we left Paul last week in chapter 11, he was engaging in what he called foolish boasting. His opponents have not only rejected Paul, they were boasting about their own superiority. And so Paul decides to get in the ring with them. He says, well, if they're going to boast, then I will boast too. This is foolish, but if they're going to boast, then I'll get in there. I can beat them at this game. Are they boasting that they have some sort of advantage and authority because they're Jewish? Well, I'm Jewish too. Are they boasting that they are hardworking, self-sacrificing servants of Christ? Well, I am even more so. Now, to set up what we're going to talk about today, let me read you Paul's description of the sufferings that he has taken on as an apostle of Christ. That starts, we're in chapter 11, starting with 23. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so. In far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death, five times I received from the Jews 39 lashes, three times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, three times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches. Who is weak without my being weak? Who is led into sin without my intense concern? So, Paul's opponents have dismissed him and boasted of their own service to God. Paul hates doing this kind of boasting, but he's saying, well, if they're going to boast about how God has called them into his service, then let's compare notes. Here is the life of service and suffering that God has called me to, so what about you guys? Paul is highlighting the seriousness and significance of his sufferings for Christ, and we talked about that last week. But if you notice, there's another theme that sort of sounds through these verses. Yes, they portray Paul as living a life of self-sacrifice and suffering. But if you think about it from a certain perspective, especially if you think about it from the perspective of his opponents, they don't make Paul look very good. He has certainly suffered a lot, but they make him look kind of weak. In verse 29, he has just said, "Who is weak without my being weak?" And now here is what he goes on to say in chapter 11, verse 30. If I have to boast, I will boast of what pertains to my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, he who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the ethnarch under Aretas the king was guarding the city of the Damascenes in order to seize me, and I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall, and so escaped his hands. So, two questions come to my mind when I read this. First, what does Paul mean by boasting in what pertains to his weakness? I mean, what has prompted that thinking? What is he responding to? And what sort of thing is he talking about? And then the other thing is, why does he tell this story about being let down in a basket in Damascus? He's had this list of sufferings, and then he talks about boasting in his weakness, and then he tells this story. Is it just another thing in his list of sufferings? Why add it at the end? It's kind of anticlimactic. He's had some pretty dramatic stuff here about being beaten with rods and whipped and shipwrecked, and then he goes out of his way at the end to throw in this story about how he was let down out of the city in a basket. So what is he thinking? What is leading him to talk about this stuff? Well, this is what makes sense to me. I think it helps to go back to Paul's so-called boasting that we've just been looking at. He said, are they Jewish? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I more so. Now, pretend that you haven't read Paul's list of sufferings that follows. He says, are they servants of Christ? I more so. What might you anticipate as being the sort of thing that he would give in a list that demonstrated what a great servant of Christ he would be? We might expect a list something like this. I am even more a servant of Christ. I converted many people in Athens. I have founded many churches. I have freed many people from demon possession. I received the blessing of the church in Jerusalem. I have preached before kings and rulers. Now, that would be a list that would show you what a great servant of Christ he is. It would be a list that was all about significance and power, and it wouldn't be a lie. Paul has indeed accomplished many impressive and amazing things throughout his ministry. But now we think about the list that Paul did give. Yes, it is a list that shows the noble seriousness of his service to Christ, but it is also the description of a loser from the perspective of his opponents. This is a messenger from God. This is the apostle to the Gentiles, beaten, whipped, oppressed, in fear for his life, psychologically and emotionally oppressed by his worries over the people that he ministers to. Where's the victory? Where's the power? Now, it seems to me that that's the very sort of criticism that Paul's opponents have made against him. This is what we've seen throughout the letter, is that there's something not very impressive about Paul in various ways. He's kind of a loser. And here, Paul seems to have played right into their hands. Yes, he shows the depths of his commitment to his gospel ministry by recounting his sufferings, but he is also giving a list that shows a certain lack of victorious power. Why are people beating him up all the time? Shouldn't he be victoriously overcoming such people? Shouldn't he be feeling strong and successful as a minister of God? Well, Paul knows that his opponents say such things about him, and he knows how this list sounds that he has just given. So he embraces the implications head on. If I have to boast, I will boast in what pertains to my weakness. I admit it. I hear about all of the things that are the problems that are happening in the church, and I am down. I am oppressed. I feel their weakness. That weakness hits me. And I've had a tough time. I've been facing death over and over again. I'm not embarrassed that this list shows my weaknesses. I admit it freely. My weakness is an important part of my true boast, he's saying. And as we'll see, Paul does not believe that serving God means being powerful. As an apostle, he sees himself as a weak man serving a powerful God. And this, I think, I mean, it's hard to say, but that seems to me is what motivates him after he talks about boasting in his weakness, to tell the story about his retreat from Damascus. This is something that happened a long time ago. This was well before his ministry started in Antioch with the Gentiles there. Again, Paul's opponents would like him to be able to tell a story like this, I think. I was opposed by the ethnarch of Damascus, but I appeared before him and frightened him with the power of my miracles. He tried to fight me, but I was too powerful. Like Moses before Pharaoh, I prevailed against him. In the end, he kneeled before me, begging me to stop and acknowledge that Jesus must be the king of the world. Now, that would be a great servant of Christ. We would take the ethnarch of Damascus and bring him to his knees. But instead, Paul tells an embarrassing story of how he had to be rescued. He was fairly young in his preaching of the gospel at this point. He had obviously stirred up a bunch of resentment against him. The Jews were involved in this plot to get him, and there was nothing he could do about it. He had to be sneaked out of the city by others. So at night, they have a window in the wall, and they put him in a basket, and all he can do is just sit in the basket while they lower him down out of the city so that he can run off from the ethnarch who's trying to get him. I think that Paul deliberately told this story to highlight his own weakness in the pursuit of his ministry. I would imagine that this event made a big impression on him. As I say, this happened fairly early in his ministry. Paul's story is not that of a powerhouse who mows down all opposition. Paul's story is of a weak man who has to be rescued from the hands of a powerful man. And yet, Paul was rescued. The ethnarch of Damascus did not defeat Paul. God delivered Paul so he could continue on in his ministry. But what an embarrassing way to be rescued. At least when Peter was in jail, an angel comes and blasts the door open and takes him out, and all kinds of great and powerful stuff happens. But here's poor Paul being ignominiously lowered down out of the wall so he can run off in the middle of the night. Paul's opponents see him as an unimpressive loser, and Paul is not running away from that criticism. Yes, in a way, I am a loser. I have suffered at the hands of many people. I didn't vanquish them with a blast of divine power. I bled when they whipped me. I sat in prison when they arrested me. I slunk away into the night when they sought to kill me. And yet, Paul has been making it clear from the beginning that his ministry is indeed a ministry of power. But it is the power of God accomplishing God's purposes. And that is what Paul is boasting in. His opponents have a worldly standard of power and victory, and by that standard, Paul doesn't look very good. But Paul doesn't care. He wants to be judged by another standard. Paul insists that where it counts, the power of God is at work in Paul's ministry. And so that's what we're going to see in this section. Paul is quite content, as he says, with the contrast between his own weakness and the power of God that is at work in his ministry, even though that makes him look bad by the standards of people like his opponents. It's interesting that Paul swears by God that he is not lying here. He seems to think that something he has said would be denied by his opponents, that they would accuse him of lying. I'm not actually sure what Paul has in mind here as what it is that he's not lying about. Is it the list of sufferings that he just gave? Is he saying, I went through all of that stuff? Is it his claim that he would boast in his weakness? Is he saying, no, that's really true? That's the way I think about it. Is it the story that he's about to tell about being let down in the basket? I'm not exactly sure why he throws that in at this point, but he is quite confident that what he is saying is true and that God knows it is true. Okay, so as we turn now to chapter 12, it might seem at first that we are abandoning this idea of boasting in weakness. We're going to look at this impressive supernatural event that Paul is going to talk about. But as you'll see as we go through it here, weakness is still very much the topic. So let me start reading in chapter 12 of 2 Corinthians verse 1. Boasting is necessary, though it is not profitable. but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body, I do not know, or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, such a man was caught up to the third heaven. And I know how such a man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which a man is not permitted to speak. On behalf of such a man will I boast, but on my own behalf I will not boast, except in regard to my weaknesses. For if I do wish to boast, I shall not be foolish, for I shall be speaking the truth. But I refrain from this, so that no one may credit me with more than he sees in me or hears from me. And because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I entreated the Lord three times that it might depart from me, and he has said to me, My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong. Okay, so you can see that Paul hasn't left the topic of weakness. He starts with this really jazzy story about a heavenly vision, and we'll look at that. But he tells that story to put in perspective what he has been saying about boasting in weakness. So really, the jazzy, exciting story is meant to provide context for this claim that boasting in weakness is the thing that he wants to do. Paul is still not happy about this boasting stuff. The Corinthians have created a situation where he feels that he must respond, but in general, he's saying that such boasting is not profitable. But he's going to move ahead, and so he tells this story about a man in Christ. Now, of course, at first, it sounds like Paul is talking about another person. I mean, I know this guy. He had a heavenly vision. But I think it's pretty clear that he is actually talking about himself. Verse 7 in particular makes it clear. He says, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given a thorn in the flesh. So it seems to me that at that spot the mask has dropped, and he's not talking about a guy who had these visions, but it's him. He's the one who had these visions. But it's interesting that he speaks of himself in the third person in this way. I think it's to highlight these two very different aspects of his life and experience. On the one hand, he is an apostle of Christ. Jesus has appeared to him personally. God called Paul through supernatural means. God works miracles through Paul. And as he says here, he was granted a heavenly revelation on at least one occasion. But, on the other hand, Paul, personally, is just a guy. Paul's opponents want to highlight all of the things about Paul that are ordinary and unimpressive, and so Paul is dealing with that topic. Yes, I admit it, I'm just a guy. I am personally unimpressive in many ways. I have weaknesses. Now, I know this other guy. That guy is impressive. That guy has been granted heavenly visions. I would really boast about that guy. But for me, all I can boast in is my weakness. And of course, we're realizing as Paul is saying this, that that other guy who's so impressive is actually Paul himself. Paul has found a very creative and compelling way to highlight his own dual experience. And he's been talking about this dual aspect to his life throughout the letter. If you've been following along with us, that started in the beginning of the letter and it's gone all the way through. He keeps going to both sides of what sort of a person he is. Like he said that he himself is not adequate for the apostolic ministry, but God has made him adequate. Paul compares himself to an earthen vessel into which a great treasure has been placed. So there's always this contrast. Paul is just an ordinary man who has been given a very extraordinary gift by God. And so here in our passage, he represents that by speaking about himself as if he's two people. There is that other guy who has the heavenly visions, and then there's Paul himself, the ordinary man, the weak, suffering servant of Christ. Paul doesn't tell us much about this heavenly experience. It would be great to know a little bit more about it. It sounds very interesting. He says it happened 14 years ago. The chronology with Paul is a little tough, but it seems like that would put it in the book of Acts. We are told about that time that a Gentile church grew up in Antioch. Paul had not been around, had not been seen by people in that area for quite a long time. Barnabas went there to seek Paul and convince him to come to minister in Antioch, and that's really where Paul enters back into the scene. He's ministering in Antioch, he goes down to Jerusalem several times, he starts his missionary journeys and everything. Well, this 14 years from when he's writing 2 Corinthians seems to put it back a little before that. So before any of the major ministry stuff that is described for Paul in Acts happens, he has this vision, this revelation. He says he was caught up into the third heaven. People really like to go crazy with this stuff, but I think it's just, as I understand it, it's a fairly simple way that they had of talking about things. As I understand it, the first heaven is the atmosphere above us. This is the place where the clouds and the rain are. And the second heaven is the sun and the moon and the stars up there above all of that. So the third heaven is the divine realm where the things of God are. At least that's how I would understand it. And he also refers to it as paradise. And I would understand him to be using just two different phrases for the same thing. He doesn't know whether his body actually went to this place or whether it didn't, so he's having a vision or some sort of out-of-body experience or something. He doesn't know. He says, God knows, I don't know. And these are the kinds of words he uses to describe his experience. He says he heard inexpressible words that a man is not permitted to speak. And he said he received revelations of surpassing greatness. So this is an amazing story. I mean, God gave Paul some sort of amazing revelatory experience, but that's as much as he says about it. He just says enough to say, I know a guy, and this is what happened to him. But as we can see, he's telling this story for a specific purpose. He's in the middle of this discussion about boasting and what he's boasting in, and he's been making these boasts about his suffering and so on. So in verse 5, he says, on behalf of such a man will I boast. But on my own behalf, I will not boast, except in regard to my weaknesses. For if I do wish to boast, I shall not be foolish, for I shall be speaking the truth. But I refrain from this, so that no one may credit me with more than he sees in me or hears from me. So here's what I think is happening here. Paul's opponents have made their criticism of Paul very personal. He's a poor speaker. He is unimpressive. There is a suggestion that seems to run through the letter that if Paul were a more powerful person, he would have better success as an evangelist. The people who turn Paul down and don't become Christians, they're kind of saying, well, that's because Paul, again, he's kind of a loser. He's not very impressive. And so it is on that level that Paul wants to talk about things, this personal criticism against him. And he's acknowledging, yes, I am a weak, ordinary guy. Nonetheless, I am also a supernaturally empowered apostle of Christ. Paul could have gone around boasting about experiences like this, saying, you know, I had this heavenly vision. I was taken up into the third heaven, and amazing revelations were made to me. And as he says, if he were to boast in this way, he would not be foolish because it would be true. But it seems as if this is the first time that Paul has ever told the Corinthians about this heavenly vision. And the only thing that has led him to do so is this barrage of criticism that is coming against him from his opponents, where he's having to step into the ring and answer the criticisms that have been made against him so that the Corinthians can get some perspective. But Ordinarily, he doesn't go around talking about this much. And I think what he's saying is, I refrain from this so that no one may credit me with more than he sees in me or hears from me. That is, Paul wants them to credit him with the things that they themselves know about him. They want to recognize who he is based on the evidence that they have seen and heard. He can tell them a story about how he had a vision, and that's fine, but that's not really the basis on which he's asking them to trust him and believe in him. And remember, throughout the letter, he's been saying to them, you ought to know me. I shouldn't have to make this defense. And this is from the beginning. This is the whole letter. He's been saying this over and over again. I shouldn't have to be saying these things to you because you know my ministry, you know me. Remember, he said, I shouldn't have to reintroduce myself to you as if I was this new person who came along and I have to bring a letter of recommendation. You are my letter of recommendation. Look around at what has happened to you since I came and preached the gospel to you. You want to know if someone would recommend me? You should recommend me, because look at what's been going on there. Last week, we saw Paul say, but even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way, we have made this evident to you in all things. So Paul's saying, you ought to have a wealth of experience to draw on, things that you have seen and things that you have heard that would lead you to have confidence in me and the things that I'm saying. So I'm not relying on this story about the vision, the heavenly vision that this guy had. Now, if I wanted to boast in that stuff, it wouldn't be foolish because it's true. I wouldn't be lying. This really happened. But that's not the basis on which I'm making my appeal to you. It's only people who have already come to have confidence in Paul who are going to be in a position to value his story about this vision. They understand who it is that's talking to them and why they would believe him that he's telling a story like that. So he doesn't really rely on stories about his heavenly revelations to commend him to the Corinthians. He would, as he says, rather boast about his weaknesses. And we're still in a position where we're trying to figure that out. What is this stuff about boasting in his weaknesses? What is that about? Well, that's where the story of the thorn in the flesh comes in. And probably most of you are familiar with this section where Paul talks about the thorn in the flesh, a fairly famous section. Here's what Paul says about this thorn in the flesh as we try to sort out what sort of a thing is it that he's talking about here. And I'll just tell you in advance, we're not going to be able to say with any great confidence that we know exactly what this thorn in the flesh is that he's talking about. But he says it was intended to keep him from exalting himself due to these heavenly visions. I mean, he had been granted a privilege that made him a uniquely significant person, having God reveal himself to Paul in that way. So the thorn in the flesh was an antidote to getting cocky and arrogant about his own importance as a one who has had revelation from God. So it was meant to keep him from exalting himself. This suggests that there was something humbling, even humiliating about it, something that would keep a person from thinking they were hot stuff. So one possibility is that it could have been a private character flaw, a humiliating temptation or struggle that he was dealing with. But it also might have been publicly visible enough to humble him in the sight of others as well. And so many go in the direction of some sort of a physical deformity or disability that he might have had. Some have suggested that Paul's eyes were bad. We do know that after the Damascus Road experience, he was blind for a while and then was healed. But we also know that he talks about how that he always signs his letters in really big letters. And one possibility is that he signs his letters in really big letters because he can't see very well. So he's making it big so that he can see what it is that he's writing. It's hard to be definitive about that. Some would suggest that he had a speech impediment, which would contribute to this perception that he wasn't a very persuasive speaker. He calls it a thorn in the flesh. Does that help us sort it out? Well, I don't think so. The flesh can be the body, but he could be using the language more figuratively as well. The flesh can also refer to our frail and fallen human nature. He calls it a messenger of Satan to buffet Paul, or it's the word angelos, so it's an angel of Satan or a messenger of Satan that is buffeting him, that's beating him up. Well, what kind of stuff does Satan do? Does that help us figure out what sort of a thing that it is? Well, there are a few things that we see Satan doing. Often Satan is pictured as a tempting deceiver, so that could support the idea that Paul has some private moral struggle, some personal temptation that he can't shake. But the book of Job also portrays Satan as visiting affliction on people to make them curse God. So Satan could be pictured as afflicting Paul physically or in some other way to cause him to stumble in a more public way that people would be aware of. So again, it's hard to be definitive, it seems to me. At any rate, Satan is beating Paul up pretty bad in some way. It's hard to be specific about what the thorn was, but it is the sort of thing that takes Paul, the supernaturally empowered apostle of Christ, and makes it hard for him to think very highly of himself. It's something that humbles him, something that brings him low when he could be thinking highly of himself as an apostle. And whatever this thorn was, it was difficult enough on him that he cried out to God to take it away. Very important statement. I don't know if you're like me, but this section has always really hit home to me in that it is about a very difficult thing in life that Paul is asking God to take away, and God says, no, I'm not going to do it. He says that he entreated God three times, and then God gives him a very famous answer. He said, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. So all along, as I've been saying here, Paul has been making this distinction about himself and how they should think about him. On my own, as a man, I am no big deal, but as a chosen apostle of Christ, the power of God is at work in my ministry, and you cannot dismiss me. And it is that very distinction that God teaches Paul through the thorn in the flesh. If Paul didn't have this thorn, whatever it is, then he would be stronger. He would feel more on top of things. Perhaps others would see him as being more impressive if it's a public sort of thorn that he has. And again, we don't know. But this thorn, this weakness in his life, reminds him constantly that it is the grace of God that is accomplishing things in his ministry, not the fact that Paul personally has it all together. The stronger that Paul is as a person, the easier it is to be tempted to think, I'm doing pretty well at this, aren't I? But the thorn brings him low. It reminds him that whatever great thing is that is happening, it is the grace of God that is bringing it about. And in fact, the power of God arrives at its fruition. It is fully what it is intended to be. It is seen for what it is most clearly when it is at work in the life of a weak man. And so, Paul can say, most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And again, I think we have to see this in the context of all of this that Paul has been doing in response to the criticisms leveled against him by his opponents and the boasting that they have been doing. Paul's opponents look at Paul and see a loser. Well, Paul is content for his life to have the qualities of a loser. He is content to be weak, insulted, distressed, and persecuted. Not, I don't think, that he enjoys those things or wants them to happen, but he sees them as an appropriate part of his ministry as an apostle. It's not that as an apostle his life ought to be free of those things. It is rather the way God does things. His opponents want him to be a person who is strong, praised by everyone, free from worries, and influential and commended by those in power. They want Paul personally to be an impressive, influential success. But when Paul is weak and persecuted, then the reality of the power of God becomes clear. I'm just remembering back in the very first chapter of 2 Corinthians, he talks about things were so difficult for him in Ephesus that he despaired of life, and he had to put his trust in the God who raised the dead. I mean, that's the sort of thing that he's talking about. I got to the place where I could not carry on. I couldn't imagine that I would be able to keep myself alive. But I am trusting in the God who raises the dead. Paul doesn't want to be seen as just another guy who is impressed with his own greatness and importance. He wants to be seen as a weak, needy human being who is supernaturally supported by the power of God. Because then it is clear that God is the one at work in Paul's ministry. So Paul is challenging the mindset of his opponents in a very clear and direct way. They reject Paul because he's not powerful and impressive by the world's standards, but Paul in turn rejects their standards of judgment. It is the work that God is doing powerfully through Paul that should be the criterion by which to judge his ministry. I can't help hearing echoes here of language that Paul used in 1 Corinthians when he was not talking about himself, but he was talking about the Corinthians. In that context, too, Paul was being criticized as not being impressive in his speech. And so Paul gets a little personal with the Corinthians in 1:26 of 1 Corinthians, and he says, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, that no man should boast before God. But by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that just as it is written, let him who boasts boast in the Lord." Well, the salvation of the Corinthians is just as much a miracle as the supernatural apostleship of Paul. He's saying the same thing about them that he would say about himself. It is not their superiority and worldly status that is going to make the difference. It is the power of God at work in them. And in a particularly humbling comment, Paul says that God chose them to highlight his own wisdom and power precisely because they were so unimpressive, which is definitely a humbling thing to say. You want to know why you're being saved? Because you're a loser, and God likes to save losers. Well, okay. So that's how Paul sees himself. He is not a personally impressive person, and his life is not the kind of life that people look at and say, "Wow, what a successful guy. I want to hang around with him." But rather, God's power is at work in him. And for those who are interested in the things of God and the things that God is doing through the gospel, the salvation he's bringing, the restoration of lives he is bringing, the growth and perseverance in faith that he is bringing, you can look at Paul's ministry and say, "Wow, something really significant is happening there." That's why he can say in verse 10, "For when I am weak, then I am strong." I am strong when God's power is at work. And sometimes it takes my own weakness to remind me that it is not me, but God who is doing these things. That's what Paul's opponents have lost sight of. It is not about who is most impressive and successful. It is about the power of God at work through the gospel. And unfortunately, the Corinthians have been listening to Paul's opponents, and some of them are becoming convinced by their criticism and their boasting. So Paul goes on in verse 11, and there's just such echoes of sadness in this kind of language when you realize the history of Paul's relationship to them. In verse 11, he says, I have become foolish. You yourselves compelled me. Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am a nobody. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles. So, Paul doesn't like this boastful way he has been talking. He doesn't want to boast in his Jewishness. He doesn't want to boast in his hardship and suffering as an apostle. He doesn't want to boast that he has had heavenly visions. But the Corinthians have compelled him. That is, they have been listening to the foolish criticisms of Paul's opponents. They have been listening to the empty boasting of Paul's opponents. And so Paul feels he has to respond. He has to set them straight. But he very much feels that he shouldn't have to do this. They shouldn't be listening to those guys. The Corinthians have every reason to recognize Paul's importance. They should have commended him. Paul came among them and performed signs and wonders and miracles. And this was an important part of the first generation, the apostles of Jesus. Just as God demonstrated that he was with Jesus by performing miracles through him, so God put his mark on the apostles by doing those same miracles. Peter performed miracles, the other apostles performed miracles, and Paul, apostle to the Gentiles, performed miracles. So look at all the evidence that the Corinthians have. Paul makes a claim to be an apostle sent by God to the Gentiles. Paul's message is endorsed by the original apostles, by Peter and James and John, and so on. Paul performs miracles everywhere he goes, including in Corinth, showing that God is endorsing Paul's ministry. Paul's teaching is wise and powerful. The gospel message which he teaches is bearing fruit among the Corinthians, which is another validation that Paul is speaking the truth. And all of this the Corinthians have seen and heard, as he's been telling them over and over, and yet they get confused by some new guys who come to town and say, Paul isn't a very good speaker, and I'm not convinced he's an apostle. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there in the letter. Next week, we will finish up the rest of the letter. As we have gone through this whole letter together, I have often pointed out that Paul is walking a kind of tightrope. And I keep saying this because it runs through the whole letter. On the one hand, Paul is acknowledging his personal weaknesses. On the other hand, he is insisting that he is a supernaturally empowered messenger of God. Well, we see that tightrope very clearly in this section. Paul is a weak man who has suffered in body and mind. He wants to boast in his weaknesses, but he is also a miracle-working apostle who has been caught up into heaven to hear surpassingly great revelations. Paul has been forced to spell this out because of the attacks of his opponents. They're saying, don't listen to Paul. He's a loser. He's unimpressive. Listen to him talk. Man, what a loser. He doesn't talk like the people that we're convinced are important and powerful and successful. And so Paul has to carefully explain, well, yeah, I don't deny it. I am a loser. It's true. But no, you still have to listen to me because I am an apostle sent by God with the message of the gospel. So what we have looked at today speaks to us in two ways, it seems to me. First of all, it tells us something about the apostle Paul, something that we have been seeing from the beginning. He is making astoundingly great claims. He is saying that God has sent him as an apostle. He's saying that God has proven that by the miracles that he has done, miracles which the Corinthians have seen. He's saying that God has given him surpassingly great revelations in the heavenly realms. So this is a big deal. This is a messenger sent from God with the message of life in the gospel. This is why we read Paul's letters, because he has made those claims and we have come to accept those claims. He's telling the truth. That is, in fact, who he is. He is an apostle sent by Jesus himself. And yet, at the same time, Paul is eager to make it clear that he himself is no big deal. He is a weak man living a hard life. And both of those things we are learning about Paul as we go through this letter, especially in this last section. Paul is coming on strong in his insistence that they listen to the gospel, and he's going to deal with anybody who's causing the Corinthians to stumble. And yet, on the other hand, he is a guy who gets beaten up regularly, who in the end cannot claim to be any big deal. It's only the thing that God is doing in him that is a big deal. But you can't dismiss that. You can't put him aside because God is doing something that cannot be put aside. So we're getting this picture, a powerful picture, an intimate picture of Paul. So that's one of the things that emerges from this section. But secondly, and perhaps more important, I don't know that it's more important, but at least it has a personal significance for each one of us. Paul is telling us, I think, that this is how God operates. That is, God's power is perfected in weakness. It is not just Paul for whom that's true. It's not only the apostles where God's power was perfected in weakness, because it's not just Paul who is weak and suffering. Christians throughout the centuries have had the same sorts of experiences. That is why so many Christians have responded to what God told Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness." As we go through life, God takes us through circumstances that make it clear to us that we're not good enough, strong enough, wise enough to make it on our own. Christians throughout the centuries have spoken of their own thorns in the flesh. One of the advantages of Paul not having specifically said what his thorn in the flesh was is that it leaves us all free to supply our own. God brings things into the lives of his people that remind them not to think too highly of themselves, not to think, "I'm pulling this off, I've got this together." There is a salvation to be had, but we are not the ones saving ourselves. There is a life of faith to be lived, but we need the grace of God to make it through to the end. The more we see the failures, the handicaps, the struggles, the weaknesses in our own lives, the more we can see God at work. That people with our liabilities would still be persevering in faith is a testimony not to our strength, but to God's grace. And I think this is a very strong theme in the New Testament. We can see it very clearly in Paul's life, but I think we face the same thing. In a way, it's a good thing to recognize that you don't have it together, and yet you're still going to make it. Okay, so we have some time left for any comments or questions you might have.
I'm going to have trouble articulating this because I'm just... Many of us were taught this passage from a very different perspective. And what I'm beginning to see in what you're saying is how really subtly wrong it was to think that Paul is asking us to emulate him, that we are to learn, even though we are strong, we are to learn to believe of ourselves that we are weak in order that we can be powerful.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And okay. I think that's how I was... I always heard the teaching where I was taught it. But rather, Paul is saying, no, I really am weak.
Yeah, right.
I don't become powerful by pretending to think that I'm weak. I really am weak. God has chosen a weak and fallible, and he's chosen a loser to accomplish his purposes. So the power that he's talking about is never Paul's power. It doesn't become Paul's power by being weak. It's always God is doing his powerful work in the world through weak vessels, through losers. Which then, and the reason now I follow you, and it makes sense that that's what he's saying, is that the emphasis in 2 Corinthians and 1 Corinthians is not one, you need to learn this technique, neither is it to defend himself. His purpose is to rebuke the worldliness of the Corinthians who would reject the substance that God has given Paul to communicate because he's such a loser.
Yes, exactly.
That's a very worldly perspective.
Right. Now, I have been using the language that he's defending himself, but
right.
I think what you mean is, and I totally agree, he's not saying, no, you're wrong, I don't have those weaknesses.
Right.
You know, I'm much more impressive speaker than you think I am, or any of that kind of thing.
Right.
It's rather, exactly, why is that significant to you?
Yeah.
Why, after all we have been through, would those things continue to hang you up about?
A couple weeks ago, you mentioned that there's nothing in, certainly here in 2 Corinthians, that gives us any indication that they're complaining about his theology particularly.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
it's not. It seems like there are people who are willing to say, oh, yeah, the gospel, mm-hmm. that's true.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is okay, Paul. It's just that you're such a loser.
Yeah. Right.
And so I don't want to, we hold you in contempt. And I think what that says to me about our situation is there's something really terribly wrong with us if we say, I accept God, but I reject the people he's chosen to do his work.
Mm-hmm.
If you hold God's methods in contempt, then don't say you don't hold God in contempt.
Right.
There's something spiritually amiss there.
Right. I think. Yeah, I mean, that thing in 1 Corinthians that I was referring to, where he's saying, you know, look at your own calling, not many of you are wise, and so forth, that's not a knockdown argument for people who are not willing to admit that that's true of them, actually, that this would be the way that God is doing things. They might rather say, no, wait a minute, you've got us wrong. So, yeah, no, I really do think that that's true. And it's one of the things that I have been struck by in going through this is how much Paul really seems to mean it when he's talking about his weaknesses and I am not that I'm adequate in myself and all of that sort of thing, that he really is, what he's dealing with is exactly as you said, is it is their contention which is being fueled by these ones that have come from outside and are criticizing Paul, but their contention that this couldn't be from God because if it was, then there would be something jazzier going on. You wouldn't be the loser that we're talking about. You would be the impressive speaker. Our entire community would be saying, wow, we got to go hear that guy Paul. He's so great. He's so impressive. And instead, we're embarrassed to bring people to hear you. And so, yeah, I think that's right. Absolutely.
I have two exegetical questions centered on that passage that Jack just talked about. He says, weakness is perfected in strength, or is it strength is perfected,
right.
perfected in weakness?
Right.
Is it using the word telos? Is it that that the idea is that...
I think, if I'm remembering correctly, yeah.
The effects of the strength are being worked out with weak people? Something like that?
Yeah, the way I was thinking about it, it is a little bit tricky. The way I was thinking about it is that I'm starting with the picture that this is the way God does things, that God, his power is being worked out in the way that it is intended, and it is arriving at its appropriate goal when his power is working in the midst of weak and fallible people. That then not only is it the power of God, but it is highlighted as the power of God and not of us. And that secondary message that don't forget that this is God that's doing this thing is as important as the powerful thing that happened itself.
Yeah. My other question was, when it says that Paul experienced inexpressible words that a man is not permitted to speak, would the Greek allow that a man is not able to speak? Like, they see things that they don't have the vocabulary to express, there's not a common enough point of reference that they would have some way of expressing it in human vocabulary?
Yeah, I was looking into that. I hadn't actually come to any conclusions about whether that was what he meant in that spot. I think that would be possible, but I don't know. I haven't, that part of it, yeah. If I were to think, what was it that made more sense in that spot? Well, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about a heavenly vision. I don't know what makes more sense when it comes to heavenly visions. We do have in Revelation and in literature like that, places where something happens and the person is about to write it down and says, don't write it down. You know, we're not, oh, rats. Okay, so there is a certain precedent for in this visionary experience of experiencing something that you were told you're not supposed to talk about. So that's possible. But the other is also...
Isn't the first question what he means by inexpressible?
Well, but that's... I think that that could go the same way as well. I think you could take that... And I'm not certain about this, but I'm thinking that it would be possible to take it either that you can't express it because it is impossible to express it, or you can't express it because you're not supposed to express it. So I think it comes back to the same thing. And I wish I had a better answer for that, but I don't. I'm not sure what to think of that.
So I have always associated, and I think was taught, although I can't really remember exactly the particulars, but that the verse, for when I am weak, then I am strong, that I was supposed to kind of like reduce myself and like all the power I felt just mm-hmm. as a human mm-hmm. being or mm-hmm. any potential strength, right. You know, like mentally make that smaller so that God can take up more room and and be God.
And that sounds similar to the sort of thing that Jack was talking about, yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to kind of figure out here is I'm trying to understand the weakness that he's talking about. He's talking about the thorn in his flesh, mm-hmm. and it sounds like the insults and the persecutions.
Yes.
Is that your understanding, like all of those things are what he's referring to as being weak?
Yeah, you can, as you put together the picture... He uses the word weak specifically when he's talking about what happens to him under the pressure of his worry for the churches. When he says, when someone is weak, I am weak, which I would translate something like, when someone is struggling spiritually, I am struggling emotionally. This is hitting me hard. So there's a weakness in the sense that I feel burdened and weighed down by the fact that this is happening. The fact that he does include as weaknesses the persecutions and all of those sorts of things, I think helps to broaden the picture as well. And like I was saying, I'm inclined to see that as the opposite of prevailing. He is not winning in those situations. He is getting beaten up. And in that sense, the fact that he is an apostle sent by God representing Christ is not giving him protection from those things. So he can't prevail. I mean, he's prevailing in the sense that they have not stopped him, and the gospel is still being heard, and God is protecting him in the sense that he has not been killed, and he is still having the opportunity to preach the gospel and so on. But in many ways, he is not coming from a place of strength. He's coming from a place of weakness. And then there's the thorn in the flesh, whatever that is too, is also, it is a thing that it humbles him. It makes it hard for him to take himself too seriously, whatever it is. So again, it's something about him. It's a place where he is weak. So all of those things together, I think what he's getting at is, as opposed to someone, like I go to a certain expert or specialist in something because I think of them as having it all together, that nothing's going to faze them here. They're going to have this, they're going to be on top of this and they're going to prevail. That's true of Paul when it comes to the truth of the gospel that he's preaching and the wisdom that he has about life that is connected with that gospel. And it's true in the sense that the power of God is working at him to demonstrate through miracles that God is with him and that kind of thing. But in a lot of ways, Paul does not have it together. He's the guy, if you go to the fair day where everybody sets up their tables for the different religions, and you have all of the popular groups, and everybody's hanging around these tables, and then there's poor Paul sitting over there, and there's a few people hanging around his table, but most of them are over here with the popular guys. You know, it's that sort of, he doesn't have that thing that would make you think he's going to prevail. The reason that he prevails at all is because of the power of God. So I don't know if that helps, but that's how I'm picturing what the weaknesses that we're talking about here.
Yeah, it struck me that the example about Damascus, because when you think about the chronology, I mean, it's almost like that's a paradigm of what you're talking about. Because when you think about the chronology, he's on his way to Damascus when he has the vision.
Yes.
He's led blind into the city. He begins to be taught by the believers, the early believers in Damascus. And we don't exactly know how long, I don't think, but we're at months at most that he's taught. And then he begins to go out and argue with the Jews in the streets. And I think the paradigm is, Paul probably thought, I would think, that, boy, who better than me to convert all of Judaism to Christianity? I used to persecute them, and now I have been converted, and you just watch my dust. And I think what he's looking at is, I was kind of a failure, wasn't I?
Yeah.
Ended up just making them so mad at me, they wanted to kill me, and I had to slink away.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm thinking of, and why it would make so big an impression, because this was fairly early, and I was thinking that same thing, is that he probably expected to be more successful at this than he was.
So, Ron, the kind of church that I grew up in, they would look at, you know, your sin and your weakness as being something that's kind of counter to the experience of being a Christian, and you just don't talk about that stuff, you know, you kind of shovel it over here. And, you know, insofar as other people in the church are, like, struggling with some kind of sin or they're unimpressive, you distance yourself from those people because that might rub off on you or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But so would you say that kind of in the light of what Paul is teaching here, that our attitude towards ourself insofar as we struggle and are weak, that should be something that we embrace if insofar as that's a reality, we continue to persevere in seeking truth and righteousness, then like that's the sign of God working in us. That's the good.
Yes.
And that insofar as other people in our midst are struggling but still trying to persevere, that we should draw near to them because you're actually seeing God working.
Yes.
You know, okay.
Absolutely. It's a great, from my perspective, it's the great tragedy of some of what happens. It's not true in every church, but in a number of the churches that I'm aware of in American culture, that exactly that thing that you said, that it's not a safe place to be transparent about your struggles because struggle indicates that there's something wrong with you. Well, yes, there is something wrong with you, but it's the wrong kind of thing wrong with you. You must not have faith or you're not really walking with God or something like that. But yeah, it is the power of God at work in weak people that we should find encouraging. So it's not the weaknesses that should discourage us, it is the perseverance in faith, or, you know, that it's that I am not going to give up on God even though I'm having a really hard time doing this thing. That's the thing that should be encouraging to us, because that's what the power of God looks like. It all depends on what you think it looks like to have the power of God at work in your life. I am not a charismatic. And part of the reason I'm not is because I don't think that's the right picture of what the power of God looks like when it is at work in your life. So I would totally agree with what you're saying, because the power of God is the will to persevere in the struggle for faith in the midst of the pressures of life. And frankly, at least in my experience, most of the most significant pressures that I have faced in my own life come from me, not from other people. So to persevere in the face of myself is what I think what the power of God looks like. So yeah, we ought to, by all means, we don't want to pull away from someone who's in the midst of that struggle.
That is so hard, though. I mean, I feel like that's something that's still like every single day I have to...
Right.
Repent.
Right.
You know, repent for how hard it is to just be honest about myself and how hard it is to see someone else as attractive when they don't look the way that I want.
Right. No, it is hard. I don't like hanging around with myself a lot of times. So why do I want to hang around with other losers like me?
Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks. We have one more session in 2 Corinthians.